and peers alike who will play vital roles in your growth and development. Our identities begin to be shaped and...
I'm a seeker, I'm a new seeker, I'm a new seeker, I'm a new seeker, oh, and the law means nothing to me.
Carol Denny. She is not a UC cop, but she has been arrested by them from her album Failure to Disperse. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and this is Bathurst Piers Broadsides, the August 15th edition. I'm just sort of beginning to tune up here. We're going to begin with an interview that I made actually about an hour ago with a community activist named Joel Kappa. Joel has been doing a lot of fighting for civil rights for folks who are enmeshed in the court system. He's going to talk about that a bit. And I'd like to read this comment. No, just kidding. He's a private joke, folks. I apologize. We here at the fun-loving Free Radio Santa Cruz sometimes get a little carried away. Joel is a man who actually is not afraid to put his tail on the line, and he's been concerned, like I have, about the ongoing drug war and how to deal with it. You can try to, of course, surveil the police at the street level and remind the police at the Citizens Police Review level of what their responsibilities are. You can sue them in court. You can try to go to the city council and begin the rather endless task of trying to get them to examine how much of the budget actually goes to the drug war here in Santa Cruz. You can use Take Me to a Magistrate to deal with victimless crimes, a defense whereby, which we've talked about before, which has had mixed results. You can do any number of things. We're going to talk about how to deal with the drug war and other victimless crimes when you reach the court level. Joel, at least, is going to talk about that and a number of other subjects. We're going to listen now to Joel Kappa, community activist.
Okay, it's August 15th, 1999. It's about 9:20, and we're talking to community activist Joel Kappa. Hi, Joel.
Morning.
And Joel, you're, what are your areas of expertise? You've been kind of, I've been seeing you...
Well, I've been forced to learn a lot of things, being a victim of the system, of felonies committed by lawyers and judges, and rampant corruption, and...
How long have you been a Santa Cruz local?
Oh, I've been here over 20 years.
And what's the last legal case you were involved in?
Well, I had my child kidnapped through the courts 14 years ago with perjured hearsay testimony by the mother, and this led to a slew of other crimes in its wake. And including a criminal conspiracy, a pervert, and obstruct justice that was actively promoted by Tom Black, who was the judge then. There was a psychologist, Don Sapoznik, who was active in on it. I went to Art Danner, who was the DA, asking him to investigate because there was evidence, witnesses. And he said he would, but he didn't. And instead, I was illegally surveilled and illegally arrested.
That's Judge Art Danner to you now.
Well, he's not a judge because anyone can disqualify him because the felony conspiracy that he entered is still open. So he's a gangster, career criminal, fraudulently sitting on the bench. And
but he's got them black robes there.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. Anyone who's had any judgment from him could go back and get it vacated based upon his being a, you know, in an ongoing felony conspiracy. You can't separate out. He can't declare when he's not being a felon and when he isn't.
But, of course, no one ever has, right?
No, I haven't disqualified him as a judge, but I have his DA, and I did this with Mike Barton. When he was DA, I went to him with proof of perjury committed by local attorney Vicky Perry. He wouldn't even look at it. I had it there in my hand, two different documents proving perjury. And I was able, not able to, but I used that as a basis to disqualify him when he became a judge.
So you've kind of mixed it up with the big boys in Santa Cruz in the DA's office. And I know
to be a parent.
Yeah, definitely. And what I've been interested in recently is the ongoing and seemingly intensifying war against basic human rights in the county around the so-called drug war, or it's actually the drug prohibition, looking for, as what they call it in Portland, Oregon, a drug peace.
And
a drug peace, rather than a drug war, wherein people who are called upon to judge these cases in juries just say, hold it, these laws are bad, and we're just not going to convict on them. And there's, of course, a national organization called FIJA, the Fully Informed Jury Association, which has been trying to educate people about their right to just say no to this, unconstitutional...
One thing I studied in history, and I went back...
Hang on a second, Joe. Let me just finish this. To unconstitutional prosecutions and laws, such as laws against fundamentally victimless crimes like possession of, quote, illegal drugs or cultivation of marijuana.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, now you were saying?
I went back and reading the history because what we were taught in 7th grade civics class is so at variance with the reality today. And saw how the pattern has been very consistent in that the citizens' rights and powers and duties have been eroded by an expert lawyer class, and that basically there's been the thrust of government has been to empower itself, to immunize and exempt itself from responsibility and accountability, that it's been a huge, massive process over two centuries now, that the original Bill of Rights is a farce and a sham. We are not under constitutional government. It's lawyers can make a case that they operate as royalty, and they're in charge, and they know it. They have a very keen sense of the power dynamics of the situation. And I've confronted a number of them with, first off, the illegitimacy of the federal government, but second, the basic status of corruption in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And when they can't bullshit anymore, they just kind of shrug and say, well, hey, we won. And I go, oh, right, law of conquest, rule by gun. We're getting honest now. So the jury still has that power. And
the power of nullification.
The power to vote their conscience. One thing I noticed in the founding period is all the states, colonies at this time, drafted their own state constitution with the Bill of Rights. And they all incorporated your right to conscience with First Amendment, free speech, freedom of religion, and jury trial, and the right to bear arms, which has only ever been envisioned as the only part of the Constitution that talks about the duty of citizens. The Second Amendment is all about killing tyrants and despots, which is the American way, not about, you know, all the other issues around guns. And they put this all together as a composite package, that they work together, that you have the conscience of the people in the jury. And if that doesn't work, you have the gun. And the as we've seen over history, both the conscience of the jury and the gun has been taken from the citizens, that we live in a police state. And but it's there, and definitely citizens need to be educated and informed about this. And I've done a couple of jury trials. I'm one for one, but if I need to do another one, I'll start in by educating the citizens on the jury about how the prosecution and the judge in cahoots are expecting to exploit and manipulate their obedience to authority to keep them ignorant.
It's very hard, however, to do that when you actually have reached the jury situation, because the judge and the DA have such power.
Well, then you...
And the jury, hang on a second, and the jury and the public really place themselves in a compliant position. They feel like they have to follow the rules of the courtroom. There is an armed bailiff there and so forth. So what I was thinking, we heard recently about the case of B.E. Smith, you know, about who was, of course, the first Californian to have a jury trial in a federal court, where he tried to use the defense of Proposition 215, the right to use medical marijuana, which they did not allow the jury to hear.
Right.
And of course, he was convicted, now I think faces 27 months in jail or something. And there was a fellow in the hallway, a bearded fellow with long hair, giving out flyers on jury nullification, according to B.E. Smith's lawyer, Tom Belanco. And he said that that actually was counterproductive, because what the judge did in the middle of the trial was he kind of pointed to this phenomenon as a sort of a sinister one and suggested they all avoid this guy, and then it indicated that there was a kind of a jury tampering going on.
Got a mistrial right there.
Well, one would hope so, but that hasn't happened yet.
No.
And the question is, you know, how do you, I've used jury nullification flyering in the past when D.A.R. Danner threatened to try me and two other people for sitting in the Heiner house back in 1992 to prevent its being forcibly, to require that it be used for homeless housing services. We wanted that, you know, that prosecution dropped, and we threatened a jury nullification flyer, and they dropped it. Now, they might have dropped it for other reasons. And I've occasionally flyered the court around general rights of the jury, the right of the jury to nullify, which means, by the way, for those of you listening, that if you're on a jury, the judge will tell you, oh, you can only judge the facts of the case. You have to respect the law, even if you don't agree with the law. That's not true.
Basically requiring
that's not true.
Your conscience at the door. I would start right in with the jury and say, you know, thank you for being here. Does anyone have a conscience? I say, those people sitting behind us want you to lose it. See that guy over there with the gun? He's going to enforce that. Now, does anybody have a problem with that? Because you're free to go right now if that tweaks your conscience. And just keep coming back to that. Does anybody have a problem?
Right, but what I'm saying is that the setting for...
You were able to preempt them, or you thought you were. And,
the setting for a defendant in these circumstances is very difficult. And it's even difficult for a person who has who's trying to flyer in the, you know, right outside the court during a trial. Right. Well, not just that. It's just that he can look like he's simply engaging in a special interest kind of pleading. Oh, he wants to get his friend off. That's why he's making this rather unusual argument, unusual in the eyes of some people who are uneducated on the issue. So in what I've been thinking, what needs to be done, actually this is a suggestion by my producer, video journalist Becky Johnson, that there be a continued ongoing effort at the courthouse to essentially inform people of their right to nullify, and particularly focus just generally on drug war cases, and talk to people about, say, look, you know, they're going to tell you you have to take this person, you know, you have to ignore what the sentencing may be, and they're not going to tell you what the sentencing of the person may be, and they're just going to say, find this person guilty or not guilty, did he or she have the marijuana in his pocket or in her purse, you know?
Well,
and you don't have to do that.
The people of Santa Cruz, you know, you'd find one person on a jury who did not want to convict on a marijuana charge, and that once you demonstrate that you're going to get that, you have effectively nullified the law, because the DA is not going to put on cases, they're not going to win.
Sure, the problem with that is that it so rarely happens in this...
Yes, but is my estimation of the general public consciousness has to be lowered a few notches.
Right, well, see, the question is how can the consciousness of the public be raised. And I'm thinking that rather than kind of wait for a particular trial to do it, the time to do it is to begin a kind of daily effort in front of the courthouse.
I've long felt that's been needed, a concerted, focused effort. There's been a lot of individuals such as ourselves pitching pebbles at the monolith, and I do know that there is some effectiveness to that. As I mentioned before, as I've done some First Amendment celebrations out front there that had the judges scurrying into their holes, and you know, they, both Tom Black and Bill Kelsey would see me in public and just head the other way, you know, just scared out of their boot heels. And the, you know, not all the players in the system are fascists, but it is dominated and run by fascists, and they're bullies, and all bullies are cowards. And when you stand up to them, they'll threaten you, oh yeah, yeah, and when you go, well, or else what, and, you know, they'll just run away and fall over. Well, I have to go get my code book or talk to my boss, or, you know, or they'll use violence on you, because they don't know what else to do. They don't have legitimacy. And just fact of, you know, a small group of dedicated citizens being out there plays in their minds.
Well, I know that you know, it's not a panacea. There were people in front of the courthouse when Sandy Loringer, the homeless activist, was tried and convicted of serving free food at the town clock back in 1989.
No.
But there is no, you know, really clear connection. I mean, I've never heard of a case where jury nullification flyering has led, you know, where a juror came off the jury and said, I read this stuff and I thought it was, you know, so valid that I decided to say not guilty.
Yeah.
You know, of course, I suppose that would then be construed as jury tampering, but whatever. You know, so I don't know about the direct causal relationship, but I think that so many people are charged with drug war, quote, crimes in our...
Or lifestyle type crime. Right, in
our county, particularly around, you know, these victimless crimes, and the jails are so packed with people around the drug war that it's become a sort of a commonplace that's, you know, kind of that's an abuse, and yet people don't know what to do about it. If we can give people the tools to know what to do about it, which is when you're on the jury, to say not guilty, period, or if you are charged with it, to demand a jury trial, in spite of all the threats and blandishments of the system, which includes the public defenders who will rush up and urge you to do a deal. Take a drug diversion, get your license suspended for 6 months, go in for testing every week. They'll go through all this stuff with you.
No, just bend over, it won't hurt so bad.
Yeah, we'll grease the scene for you there.
Yeah. And the DA routinely overcharges, and then they'll reduce the charge like they're doing you a big favor. Like, you should take this and be grateful.
Right, of course, when I propose this, I'm speaking fancifully, in the sense that I'm not clear that when or where this effort, I mean, I'm clear where it should begin, probably in the steps of the courthouse. I would like to see if people are interested in this effort in terms of, you know, setting up a regular table, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day, or 1 or 2 hours a day.
The morning time, typically.
You know, when the people, early in the morning, 8 to 9 even, would do it. When people come in, where people can not only be informed of their rights as jurors, but they can also be informed, they can talk about their cases. I was fucked over here by the, you know, here they came in, they grabbed my, you know, me for this and this.
We've both been gathering a lot of anecdotal information.
Get a bunch of people to say, we are the ones who are being prosecuted. Our lives are being ruined. Our families' lives are being ruined. And your money is being spent on this incredible war, you know. And I think once we get the specifics, and once a number of people begin to realize that they can't be picked off one by one, I mean, they can still be picked off. We haven't got any magic wand here. They have the guns. They have the power. But there is a greater power when people begin to, you know, realize and link together and say, no go, no way. And I think that can happen if people realize that there's some place where they can meet and talk and share concerns and do so even in a semi-public way, although, of course, that's kind of risky for folks.
Well, sign me up for a morning or a week. You know, the courthouse is pretty much the juncture where citizens interact with the state, and it's usually kind of brutal.
And it's also true that, I mean, this business of just laws not only applies to the drug war, but it applies to laws, for example, that persecute homeless people.
Sure.
And the reason it's more effective in dealing with, when you deal with the drug war, is because mostly the laws used against the homeless are infractions. And so infractions don't involve jury trials. They involve...
Well, I've been waiting for the chance to have a jury trial on having no auto insurance because I have a thick file pretty well proving that the auto insurance industry in California is run as a criminal racketeering enterprise. And many of my fellow citizens have a problem with that, with they buying a law for about $15 million where they rake in $2 to $3 billion as a result of it. I said, do you think this is just, you know, there are a lot of bad laws. I was reading one of Reagan's drug policy advisors who was somewhat candid after the fact, and the guy was researching the whole drug war and policy. He said, well, how can you justify this drug war for these victimless crimes? And he says, oh, but just me, and you know, people like me, knowing that people are doing this is harmful. So they create themselves as the victim, where there isn't one. So, you know, they're self-victimizing in their own mind, but they're going to project it out on innocent people.
Well, usually what's done around the drug war is they cite youth as being the victims, people under 18.
Right. And more vulnerable people.
And they also cite... Well, I mean, I guess they talk about people who drive under the influence of drugs or people who commit other crimes under the influence of drugs. But again, these things are obviously secondary phenomenon, and they have laws that you know, that pertain to them. If you're a criminal, if you engage in criminal behavior, like you assault someone, then you do. You know,
my point was, and with the drug war and with a lot of these lifestyle crimes, so to speak, is there are laws that cover actual transgressions. And
right.
If somebody, you know, injures someone, you know, let justice be done. But, you know, let's not go out harassing and oppressing people because of the way they look and what we think they might do. I mean, there's incredible mental illness in the system. And, you know, they're the persecutors and they need victims. And they go out and get them. And it's now an industry where they have their entrenched self-interest and they take it as a vested right to be at the trough, and you know, RoboCop has to do something. And they, you know, I mean, you think about it, the police and the whole criminal justice system, if they're really successful, they won't have anything to do. They'll put themselves out of business.
You know, it's what's been said occasionally of local Santa Cruz police officers, that, you know, that they get more and more cops, but they seem to have less and less to do. And I tend to see only one portion of the picture, the downtown picture on Pacific Avenue.
No.
But crime rates have been dropping, and yet police department staffing has been rising. And of course, the drug war forfeiture scandal is a whole different story. You know, the huge amounts of money that police departments and DAs and so forth get through these seizure of property.
Well, just like Janus and the recovery places, they are now dependent upon the courts feeding them clients for their budget.
Yeah,
so it becomes entrenched as a cottage industry that taken together is quite huge. And they have a self-interest to perpetuate it.
We're talking to Joel Kappa, a local activist. And Joel, are you, any particular projects coming up that we should be aware of?
Well, I've been focusing on my writing. I just put together a essay out of my book on the drama triangle of victim, rescue, and persecutor, the drama triangle in the world. Fascism as an emotional disease is something that's treatable and analog to alcoholism with lots of drama and trauma. And by destigmatizing it, by reframing it as a treatable condition, you neutralize the nasty name effect of it. Oh my God, a fascist. You know, I mean, you remember 40 years ago, the most horrible thing was to be an alcoholic. Now, if you have a problem with drinking, you take care of it. You go to AA. You know, I'm looking forward to that day when it's no longer socially acceptable for people to derive emotional gain from injuring and oppressing others under color of authority.
Well, of course, sounds like you're attacking the whole patriarchal family system here.
Kind of an educational, psychological approach, and I keep coming back to, for all the horror that's out there, that it's really incumbent upon each and every one of us to educate our minds and to I mean, we absolutely need to have a minimum of legal self-defense, of knowing what our rights are, of not permitting illegal searches and so on, not encouraging bad cop behavior, and let them know. I mean, I've had, I try to avoid police, of course, and encounters I do have is they don't seem real eager to want to get into it with me because I'm not a good victim.
Well, maybe we can have a special sort of recovered victim program that will enable you to retrain yourself.
Good.
And you can become a victim again,
Joel. You know, and I am disabled due to stress disorder, and it's not post-traumatic.
I was kidding about becoming a victim. Yeah.
And, you know, with the people who are involved in the system are injured by it, and this includes the lawyers and judges and cops and clerks. You know, you think about it, is they're spending 8 hours a day under this bunker mentality. And, you know, they can't help but be adversely affected by it.
But they do get enough for their homes and, a pleasant sinecure and an opportunity to raise a family. Because that's sort of like what happened in Germany in the 30s and 40s in the most dramatic form. And I guess what happens in a lot of modern countries, Germany always gets the... Sort of gets the bad rap because it's sort of such a dramatic instance.
It's just a matter of degree. There are more fascists in America than there everywhere in Germany.
Really?
No,
we'll have to have you prove that allegation in our next interview.
The works of Adorno and Altmaier go into the authoritarianism, the authoritarian personality, the fascist scale, and depending upon how you profile for it, you know, like a high end or a low end, they're between 40 and 80 million fascists in America. And when you...
That's a topic we can't talk about now because we're running out of time.
Okay, another day.
But I do want to go into... I'm really hoping we can get some public response to this proposal that there be a really continuing presence at the courthouse around issues of the rights of the public, the rights of jurors, and the need of people victimized, and I use the word victimized because the drug war victimizes people,
right.
And it doesn't have, the so-called victims are the people that are being eaten up by the police department
and
the courts.
I consider the war on drugs the florid symptom of alcoholism when you study where it came from.
Again, something we'll have to talk about later, but if you're interested in this, give a call. You can, of course, call into this radio program at 427-3772, or you can give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, if you think you're interested in becoming a part of this project.
And that was activist Joel Kappa talking to us earlier this morning. Again, the proposed project, a inform and unite kind of table outside the courthouse at 701 Ocean Street, where folks come every morning to pay and humiliate themselves before our judicial system, often, frequently, who knows, might even be in a majority of cases under the drug war, although again, I don't have that specific stat. We do know that the prison industry is booming thanks to drug prohibition. So if this interests you, if this idea interests you, you might want to give us a call and talk about it. I mean, are we barking up the wrong tree? Are the drug laws fine? Is it a useless, hopeless struggle? Is there any point in going to the courthouse with a table and informing people that they have the right to nullify, they have the right to say no? For those of you who aren't familiar with court procedures, to find a person guilty requires a unanimous verdict of 12. Also, to acquit a person requires a unanimous verdict. But if one member of the jury refuses to vote unanimously either way, the jury is considered what we call hung, or it is a mistrial. And that means the district attorney can choose to try the whole case again or to dismiss it. And that means that really only one or two people on the jury, if they feel strongly enough that people should not be jailed for victimless crime, use of drugs, or use of marijuana, that they can say no. And in saying no, they can essentially stop the DA and really send the message to the district attorney's office that there's a much better way to be spending our time and money than on jury trials, which cost often $10,000 to $20,000 at a minimum, if you take into account all the the court time of the bailiff and the court reporter and the public defenders and the DA and so forth. So it is a really potentially powerful tool. Of course, there are ramifications and consequences, and you will, no doubt, I will, if I do this, and I will be doing this, not if I do this, but when I do this, will be threatened with arrest, will be threatened with prosecution for tampering with juries, for contempt of court, you name it. But in fact, all we're trying to do is to inform the public, and that includes jurors, and that includes defendants, that includes judges and district attorneys, that they have the right to make a decision not simply on the narrow basis that a judge directs them to decide on. However much they feel intimidated or restricted, we're going to remind them that they give the judges what power they have. They are themselves, in a way, the fourth branch of government, as the Fully Informed Jury Association so aptly puts it. They are the people who, once these bureaucracies pass the laws at the legislature, and then the executive decides for political reasons to enforce the laws, as they have with the marijuana laws, and they have done in the past with draft laws, or with slavery laws, or with laws against women voting, or with laws against forming labor unions, then the and if the local prosecution wants to prosecute that and the judges want to affirm it, these are all elites. The only place where it really touches ground and touches the people is on at the level of the jury. And of course, it doesn't touch all the people. It touches those who are on driver DMV lists and voter registration lists. Is that where they, I think that's where they get the jury list from now. I'm not entirely sure the exact place at the moment, but one of the two, I believe. That's where the public, the real community, the people have their say. And if the people says, we don't want to convict, we think the law sucks, we think the prosecution is selective, we don't have to believe, you know, we think the penalties are too much, the judge will always tell you, you can't decide that, you know, we're not even going to tell you what the penalties are. You have to just make a decision, did he or she have this marijuana on her? If she did, well, that you just tell us that, and then we'll send them to jail. And we'll decide how long. And we won't even tell you beforehand what the range of possibilities is. So in essence, 12 people are being told to dispose of another person's life without knowing what's going on. And that's where this kind of tabling, this kind of flyering, this kind of information to the public is important. So if this seems like an interesting idea to you, give a call. Let's talk about it here on the air at 427-3772, or give a call to HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUF. That's a voicemail that I am using, and it's also the voicemail for HUF. HUF is an organization concerned with civil rights for homeless people, and of course, homeless people have been suffering from victimless crime laws for a very long time, because the what they do is they are in public spaces where conservative voices in the community don't want them to be, and police don't want them to be, and merchants don't want them to be, and so they suffer under things like the sleeping ban and the spare changing ban and the sitting ban, laws all passed with the connivance of our current city council, including Michael Rotkin, and in most cases Mayor Byers was on board for making it illegal to ask for change peacefully after dark, for instance, or to sleep. She passed the sleeping ban in March, making it a $54 crime to sleep outside. And her defenders say, well, she reduced it from $162. Well, now being Jewish only costs you, a fifth of your property instead of all of your property? I mean, that's the kind of thing it is. They're criminalizing people for things that they cannot help but do. And they're criminalizing them for their status. It is, in essence, just such a flagrant violation of civil liberties that it kind of shocks the conscience that people in this town allow it to continue, and that judges entrusted with enforcing the Constitution allow it to continue. But they do. And that's why when Joel uses the word fascist, which I don't use much because it's too loaded. People immediately say, oh, you're exaggerating, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, these aren't, you know, economic corporatists from the 30s, and they don't have swastikas and so forth, so they're not fascists. I mean, after all, you know, the city councilor is in session, and you have lawyers and courts and so forth. But the truth is that if laws are in place that criminalize whole classes of people, it certainly sounds fascist-like. And whether you want to call it this or call it that, the important thing is to call it by what it is. And that's what I try to do here, and that's what I hope you out there try to do when you see it happening. And, of course, the best thing to do if you see police misconduct happening is to stop on the street and take a deep breath, realize you're going to be a little bit late to work, but oh well, and observe. And if it seems worthwhile, call a few other people over to observe. I tend to get pretty vocal in those circumstances, and I think it's quite appropriate. You don't interfere with what's going on. You just you call upon the community to observe what the police department is doing, whether it be harassing a Free Radio Santa Cruz person sitting at a table from selling T-shirts, messing with a homeless person at the back of the New Leaf Market in the parking lot there from washing windows when she or he has been given explicit permission by the management to be there, and there's no complaint from a person, from anybody whose car is being offered to have their windows washed. It's simply the police taking this decision that they want to have a more cosmetic town. That same kind of mentality that had them throw Steve Argue to the ground on November 12th for us trying to sell the street newspaper Street Spirit in front of the New Leaf Market without apologies, false arrest for 4 days, brutality that resulted in physical injury to Steve, no compensation, and even the police review board backs them up. Anyway, that's the kind of stuff that we have to stop. That's the kind of stuff that you out there are empowered to stop, because the police aren't going to do it, and Christopher Crone and the city council, they're not going to do it, and the Citizens Police Review Board, they're not going to do it. It's the people that have to do it, and if the people start to do it, then these other groups will jump on board. You bet, they always do. So I had kind of hoped to have a better organized show, don't I always, this morning. And but why don't I don't, as you can hear, I have a kind of a, I'm improvising as ever on Bathrob Spears Broadsides here at 96.3. But what we have is lots of interesting stuff, lots of interesting tapes. We're going to play you now an interview with a woman who actually does squeegee windows, or did before she was arrested a week ago, on warrants, again, for minor quality of life matrix-type crimes, you know, victimless crimes, but crimes that the police feel require spending your money to put her in jail. I had hoped to get more information about her, but I haven't heard from her. Her partner has also sort of disappeared from the New Leaf parking lot. He may still be around, not just be there when I've been coming through, but I go there frequently and haven't seen him in the last few days. His name is Chico. I hope you're okay, Chico. Hope you're okay, Patches. But here's an interview with her that happened about a week and a half ago, right before she went to jail. She actually suffered a heart attack, not related to any police misconduct, certainly, and she got good treatment from the paramedics, and she commended them for that. But then the next day, she was in jail for, quote, warrants, those warrants. She's quite a public figure. She's not like she's trying to avoid warrants. She's out there every day squeegeeing windows. Let's hear what she has to say about a number of things. It's certainly worth listening to.
Well, we're talking to Peachy Patches here, who you say that people without a place to stay have a particular quandary here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, we don't know where to camp. I mean, they say we can camp and they won't bother us on private property, but then they give us tickets for sitting on public property. Well, what's public property, what's state property, what's city property, what's county property? You know, there's got to be some specific areas here. Mm-hmm. And people are getting harassed wherever they camp. And they hassled us the other day, and I don't know if I say all of that, but anyway, it was, I believe, county property. And
So where did you sleep last night, more or less?
On the levee.
Did you get hassled?
Not last night, but last week.
And how did that happen?
They just drove up on us on the levee on their bicycles and told us we had to move, and it was 9 o'clock in the morning, asked what we were doing, and we said we were getting up to get ready to go. Mm-hmm. I told them I'd be out of there by noon, got my stuff all together. They came back at 10:30 and told us we had to go out there or we were going to go to jail.
Really?
And I'm not sure if that's county, city. This guy really doesn't know how to drive.
Well, he's got problems with the van there.
And so anyway, yeah, we don't know where we can camp, where we're legal or where that it's safe. And we got to be more than ones. You know, it's got to be 2 or 3 or 4 people. Or we might get, you know, hurt by the troll busters also. So it's between the cops and the troll busters. And I haven't heard of any troll buster things happening lately. Yes, that is very good. But it's like, how do you distinguish county, state, city?
And so forth. Thank you.
Et cetera.
You know, we're in front of New Leaf Market and we're talking to...
Get to that interview in a moment and on another subject, but first let's kind of pursue this harassment of homeless people for life, not just lifestyle crimes, but life sustaining behavior like sleeping. For 4 days last week there was a celebration at the town clock. Part of that celebration had to do with what's called the Dark Goddess, and I read a bit about that at the last Bathrop's Piers broadside show, which I do on Thursdays from 6 to 8 in the evening. But part of the celebration was also concerned with political freedom and the rights of poor people and homeless people to sleep. Police allowed this celebration to continue for one night, but on the second night they arrived in force and apparently threatened the people at the town clock that they were there after, quote, park hours. Now we're talking about that little triangle of territory around the clock, a cement area which was declared a park. And actually was declared closed as a park by the city council after 1 o'clock, specifically in order to prohibit the use of that area by homeless people and by political protesters. And that happened in 1991 under the administration of Jane Yokoyama, or as I used to call her, Jane Hoki Mama. She again was part of your progressive right-wing gang, the Rotkin group, the Rotkin Matthews group, that kind of pretended to be liberal but had nothing but... indifference, arranging, and false sort of false liberal pity for the poor without, and essentially disrespect and contempt for their basic rights. And in 1991, the Yokoyama Council, which included such people as Mike Rotkin, actually no it didn't, not at that time, it included such people as Neil Coonerty, then owner of the, still owner of the bookstore Santa Cruz, then on the city council. It included Louis Rittenhouse. They made it illegal to sleep at the town clock park. And not just legal to sleep, it's been illegal to sleep there anyway. They made it illegal to walk, be, or in any way sit in the park after 1 o'clock, just as all the other parks in town have been closed to the public at dusk. This park was closed at 1 o'clock. And this was specifically to deal with the protest by two protesters, Wanton Dave Jacobs, sort of an old Vietnam vet, used to have a very colorful bathrobe that he would sport, and he was concerned about peace, specifically opposing the various foreign adventures that the Bush administration undertook, and also the rights of homeless people to be allowed to be in public spaces. That doesn't mean to set up house and block the sidewalk and mess everything up. No, just to be there without being removed, because the merchants decided it would be a better selling point not to have them around it, because their bodies interfered with the flow of money. Well, the city council, of course, passed the downtown ordinances and a whole series of laws, and again, even 3 years before that, the town clock was closed at the behest of the city council in the middle of a long 3-month protest run by, well, mainly staffed by Dave Jacobs and Robert Flory at that time. So the Dark Goddess celebration happened there last week, and we're going to hear an interview now with one of the, if not the key person behind that celebration ceremony. She was, I believe she's the one who wrote the flyer about it. Let's hear directly what happened when the Dark Goddess folks tried to do a little exercise, a little religious freedom that bothered nobody, but apparently offended... Chief Belcher's Police Department. It's August 12th, 1999, and it's about 8:10. We're here at the town plot with the Dark Goddess Vigil, talking to...
Hi, I'm Tina.
The Tina, I might add.
No, I want to be called Dragonfly.
You want to be called...
Dragonfly.
Dragonfly, you were here last night at 3 o'clock when certain individuals with guns arrived, and what happened then?
Well, he had his baton out, and as if he was going to need it, and let us know that the park was closed, told us to leave, told us to take all of our stuff, and gave us about half an hour to do it. When he returned, by the time he returned, we had removed all the valuable things, but we're hoping to be able to leave the rest of it for 4 hours until the park opened again. And when he returned, he said that he would have to book everything left over. Everything left here, he'd have to book.
Who was this fine gentleman?
I didn't deal with him that much. I talked to him. I'm the one who dealt with him. But I kept the interaction very short.
You didn't notice his name?
No. I avoid just dealing with that.
And was he alone, or did he have officers with him?
The first time, his car rolled up with no other officer, and the second